Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. One of the most popular musicals in the world, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat by Andrew Lloyd Webber, one of his first works and really the work that put him on the map. 20 years ago, the Racine Theatre Guild mounted a production of Joseph, which is to this day one of the most successful productions in this company's long history. Joseph is back this year, and it opens this Friday night and runs for performances through the first weekend in June. And after a long rehearsal, I'm really grateful in this busy tech week that four people with central roles in this production are joining me for a few minutes for this part of the morning show. The boss is here, Doug Instanis, who is the artistic director here at the Racine Theatre Guild and the director of this production. Seated next to him is Mary Lee Storino, who is the choreographer for this production. And I'm pretty sure it's the first time she has done anything with the Theatre Guild. So it's a splashy way to begin the relationship. And then we have two of the central members of this large cast for Joseph. Our Joseph, first of all, Noah Chartrand, who is a senior at Horlick High School. And Kara Ernst Schalk, who has been a choreographer for many productions here at the Theatre Guild and stage director for other productions, and has been on this stage any number of times as a performer as well, and she is the narrator. So I welcome all of you and thank you for your time with this interview. Doug, say a word about the return of Joseph after 20 years. I don't think it's all that typical for works to come back sometimes ever, and not, and they don't tend to come back very often. Talk about the occasion of Joseph returning to this stage.
Well, I would say at least once or twice a year, someone would say, "Oh, when are you going to bring Joseph back?" And each year we talked about it on the play reading committee because it was such a huge hit at the Theatre Guild. We played, I think, five weekends, plus we had a number of buyouts for churches and things, and a cast of over 50. And they were really working hard. And so after a while, we kept the set for, I think, 15 years. And then we said, well, let's get rid of the set. We need room. We've got all these things. And then, of course, then we decided we're going to do it again. And but it's a different set, different company, different situation. So, you know, we had always talked about bringing it back sometime. We just never knew when the time was right. And we just thought that this would be a perfect year to do that, and we're very lucky because we have some cast members that were able to return, some crew members that had worked on the show that were able to return, and everybody has their favorite Joseph story and what they either had to wear or what they had to do or how many performances they had to do or how quick the changes were. So it's been kind of a legend at the Theatre Guild, so we're starting a new production, and it's very different than the original production, but it still will be a lot of fun.
Right. I know that you were not the director of that, Joseph. Norm McPhee, your predecessor here at the Theatre Guild, a name that a lot of people know, he directed that production. Did you have really anything to do with it, or were you just sort of eavesdropping on it from afar, or did you have any role in this production?
I was only here for a couple of years, and at that point I was doing directing a couple plays and doing the marketing. But because it was such a huge show, we were all helping build sets, focus lights. I remember going with Norm to Chicago to get the costumes because he had rented all of those. So besides my marketing duties, we have a small staff here, so we all have to help out. But I didn't have anything artistically to do with it. I just had to make sure their names were spelled right in the playbill.
That was a big cast, I remember. Compare the size of that cast to the size of this cast. Is it comparable?
No, they were much bigger. I think they had 55 in the show, and we had 40. We have 42. And they had a much bigger children's choir than we did. And I think they had a few more gentlemen. They had brothers, and they also had wives, and they also had a couple other people in the show as well. But I think their total was 55. But I thought 42 was pretty big, so
I was happy with that. Mary Lee is shaking her head in dismay at the thought of trying.
Where are you going to put them all?
Yeah, that would really be something. Say a quick word about the background of this musical, whatever you happen to know in terms of the circumstances under which it was written. It has sort of an interesting evolution.
Well, my understanding is when he wrote this, it was a kind of a concert piece. And then my understanding is his father encouraged him to rewrite it into a short play. And then they kept expanding it in the 60s, and then it has continued to grow. Recently, the big versions with Donnie in Chicago and them adding the mega mix to it. We were trying to decide if it has changed much since 1920. I have an old tape of the show 20 years ago, and we were trying to compare. Uh-huh. Were the songs in the right place? Everybody's got a different memory of how this show worked. So there have been changes, most notably the Megamix after the Donny Osmond version. There's a movie version with Donny, and every 5 years or so they seem to send out a new touring company in London. And I think every high school in America has done this at one time or another. So it's been hugely popular, and it's because people just want to have fun and they enjoy the music, and sometimes you just want to go and know something that's familiar and fun.
And that is this. I want to turn to our two cast members for a moment. Kara Ernst Schalk, I remember learning at some point, I don't remember if it was even before or during or after the auditions, that the role of the narrator has been on your bucket list for quite some time. Why is that? What was so enticing to you about this role? Why did it mean so much to you, and why are you so grateful for this opportunity to be the narrator?
Because she's a woman who has an amazing amount of stage time. That's number one. No, like Doug said, the music is so fun, and it's very uplifting. Her character is kind of, she's an outsider from everybody. She's a little bit associated with the kids, but she kind of runs through the entire storyline and keeps it driving forward. But the nice thing is she also gets to interact. So she can be out in her own world, but then she can also jump into the action when it seems to be the most fun. So, I was a kid of the 80s, and I loved listening to Andrew Lloyd Webber, and this was one of his hits. So, of course, you have to sing this, and you grow up dreaming to play this role. And, there aren't as many professional and community theater productions anymore. They're still out there, but not as much as in the 80s and 90s. So for it to be up and running again, it's really exciting to have the opportunity.
Right. Did you know going in, obviously on some level you knew what a big role it was, what a big learn it was going to be. Were you prepared for and you've learned it really, really well and remarkably quickly, but did you really know what was going to be involved in learning this much music?
I think so. Like I said, I knew this show inside and out, 80s and 90s, which was quite a while ago. When I actually worked crew backstage when they did it 20 years ago, and you internalize a lot of it. You came to the show knowing the music before you even walked in the door, and you get caught in the VOM singing. I got caught in the tent singing, waiting for a quick change. So, you can't help but sing it, and it does get stuck in your head. But it is challenging. She's got a lot of patter, which is real fast. How fast can you spit out words and still be understood? which is difficult because I had lost the muscle memory of that from my childhood teenage years. So it was a challenge, and it's the challenge of once we hit go, it doesn't stop.
Right.
You know, there isn't a moment to catch your breath and change something if you've made a mistake, which is absolutely terrifying but also thrilling as an actor.
Sure. Absolutely. Doug, you and I both know that we had an incredible array of women who auditioned for this role. And I wonder if you could just say a word about what you think Kara brings to this role, what made her such a strong choice.
Well, she teaches in a parochial school, and that's the person who does the show. So we needed a parochial school teacher, and that was the only one I knew. So, no. Actually, Kara has being a teacher and teaching kids classes, she really relates well with kids, and that comes across really well. This person is telling the story. The narrator tells the story to the kids. That's what it's all about. And then we, you know, interpret it, and she interprets it, and it gets bigger and broader, and we act it out. But it really is about a teacher and her students. And that narrator role has to have a lot of things. She has to have that compassion with the kids, and then has to have a little attitude. And Kara has a little attitude, too. So she can be sassy and fun and playful and strict and all the things that a good teacher can do. And she sings and dances really well. So, Mary Lee and I talked about exploiting her dancing skills a little bit more than maybe they did 20 years ago or other productions do, where she could dance a little bit more, she could interact with the guys and the kids a little bit more and use some of her dancing skills as well. So she had a lot of different things that brought to the table, and I think I made the right choice.
And I think we feel really good about our choice for the title character as well. Noah Chartrand, a senior at Horlick High School, is singing the role of Joseph. Noah, how long have you dreamt about this possibility of doing the role of Joseph?
Since I was in seventh grade, I think, was the first time that I was actually in Joseph. I played Benjamin.
At Where was that?
Park High School.
Oh.
Jay Rattle put on the production, and I auditioned. It was my second show there, and second show ever. Mm. and I got Benjamin. I was ecstatic, and ever since then, I've kind of just wanted to play Joseph. Mm.
And, of course, you also get to interact with just about everybody in the cast, including the children, and that's kind of fun to watch from the wings and to see the rapport that you are establishing with our children's chorus, because you're also a big part of the telling of the story to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely love the fact that I get to interact with basically the whole cast. It really places myself within it, and it helps me like get into character more, and basically, yeah.
Very good. Sitting next to you is Mary Lee Storino, who is the choreographer for this. And, of course, this is a huge dance show. And so it's quite a way to get started at the Racine Theater Guild with a production this big. Just say a word about the show and kind of the nature of these big dance numbers and what you have wanted to do.
Sure, yeah. So unlike my colleagues, I had never really gotten into this one for whatever reason. Never really struck my fancy, didn't really know a whole lot about it, truthfully. Coming in, I'd never done it. I've only seen one production of The Fireside when I was probably 9 years old. So, and that was in the round. So, you know, it's, so I didn't come in knowing, you know, as much as a lot of other people did. So that was really fun for me to research. And very quickly, I found out that pretty much every number has a different style, which was really fun as a choreographer because you don't get stuck, you know, doing the same sort of things over and over again. I mean, we have a very sensible amount of grapevines. But besides that, you know, there's a calypso number, there's a Fosse-esque, you know, dance, jazzy kind of number, there's a hoedown. So it was fun to pull from all the different styles and, you know, put it on these adults who have, you know, done a really great job taking off with it.
What was involved, I mean, like, for instance, when Kara choreographs a show here, she really has a really good sense of what people can do, because in many cases she's choreographing for people who've been in, this is their sixth or seventh show. You were really, at least for the most part, choreographing for strangers.
Pretty much, yes, and that was a huge challenge right off the bat. After the hoedown rehearsal, which was the very first dance number that we learned, I went home and I was like, okay, now I feel like I have a better understanding of, you know, different people's abilities and strengths and all that. But yeah, whenever you get, you know, 25 adults on stage trying to do the exact same thing, it's always challenging.
Right.
So, you know, but besides that, I think that just... I've learned so much about the space, the stage specifically here, and, you know, the people who, are veterans, if you will, of the Guild. So hopefully I'll get the opportunity to work here again, because I think I, you know, next time I can really hit the ground running right away, a lot less learning curve. But,
it's
been fun getting to know everybody.
Cool. And we should probably clarify, too, that when people audition for anything at the Guild that's a musical, there's a dance audition that's part of it, so it's not like... people showed up to that first dance rehearsal and you had absolutely no idea of people's abilities, but that's not the same thing as really knowing thoroughly what people can do and how quickly they learn.
Exactly. And like I said, because there are so many different styles, you know, it's hard to get everybody moving in the exact same way in the exact same style. So that was challenging as well. But I think if you come see the show, it's great.
And then you throw 16 kids in there and say, teach them something.
Yes.
Or what I said to her, I need something right here. Can you just come up with something,
something
now?
And I'm not a wing it kind of person. I am a planner. I go home and I make little X's and I make diagrams and you're going to be here and you're going to be here. Okay, this is all good. So, yeah, to wing it, sometimes I'm always like, oh, okay, well, I hope this doesn't come out, you know, bad.
Right. Well, so far, so good.
Yeah.
Doug, say a word about how spectacular the stage looks. I mean, before even a single person has walked out onto the stage, just the, sort of the feast for the eyes that this production represents.
Well, one of the nice things about the Theater Guild is we have a lot of great tech people. And we have a lot of people that work really, really hard for no money. And it is just very humbling. Katie Coble is doing our costumes. And her group of, 30 people who have sewn and coming down here night after night putting the costuming together. Jill Dickert has been doing our props and been working on making sheep and sheep that can be ripped apart and fans. And Chris is our technical director, has been working on building the enormous pyramid that goes into that. And Sarah Hunt Frank is our designer from Milwaukee who has been here with volunteers painting for the last 2 weeks. And then Brian Herpchek is doing lights and with Kevin Edmonston. And they're here in the middle of the night because that's the only time that you get the stage time to work on all these lighting effects. And I know for a fact Cara and our lighting guy were working on sound so that the sound syncs in beautifully with the lights. So when they go red and green and yellow, all the lights change at the right time. And just 15 seconds of a light cue may take 3 hours to program. Mm. And they don't get paid. And I am just amazed at the amount of work I get out of people for no money.
Yeah.
It's just it's an amazing thing. And so I'm very blessed and very honored to work with them because they've worked really hard. And we still have a few days to go and finishing that up. But every day the costumes are getting better, and it's just visually, this is a musical comedy, okay? This is not Les Mis dark drama, so it needs to be fun. The costumes need to be fun. They need to be able to dance in them because she's got them jumping and flipping and going upside down and all sorts of things, and the lights need to be bright. We've got, of course, the Joseph sign that's LED lights, and so we're using some new technology. So I think... The visual aspect of the play people are going to be impressed with. I think the vocals, I think the dance, I think it's all really coming together. And I really think people will really, really like the show.
I want to give everybody a chance to talk about a favorite moment. But, Cara, I want to first ask you, because you've been in love with this show for such a long time, probably, and I'm just curious, what about it made you fall in love with it? I mean, you kind of alluded to the fact that, like, the whole world was in love with Andrew Lloyd Webber back then, and maybe that you were just swept along by the tidal wave, but I suspect it's more than that.
Yeah, it's got great melodies. I mean,
like it or not, you're going to walk out the door singing the songs from this show. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, it is a relatively simple melody, but it's really nice. I mean, some of the ballads in this show are soaring and lovely, and we get to listen to Noah sing them every night, which is a double bonus. And you asked about kind of favorite moments. One of my favorite moments, I get to sit at the end of one of our tunnels and look up on stage, close every door, which closes Act One. And to listen to him and the lighting and the effect that the children give, and just to be able to actually be an observer in that moment is really cool. There's just, it's a lovely moment that I've always loved, and he and everyone else involved, from the lighting to the sound, everything really has come together, and it's beautiful. It's really cool. Gives me goosebumps to think about.
That's what we want. Noah, favorite moment for you, and I'd prefer it not to be that moment, but although you're welcome to choose whichever one you like.
I think my favorite moment was I came into one of the rehearsals, and we got all ready, and we got all costumed up, and I went out on stage, and all the warm-ups and all that jazz, and we started, and it kind of felt like a cloth was kind of being draped over it, and it was like everyone was in character and everyone was on point on that rehearsal, and it was just like mind-blowing to actually see it all come together, and it was just an amazing thing, and really drove me to perform all these performances.
Right, yeah, so when it starts to feel like we're not rehearsing this anymore, practicing anymore, now we're starting to actually do it. Mary Lee, do you have a favorite moment from the show?
I do. Well, in general, the hoedown is probably my favorite scene. It was my favorite thing to choreograph. Everyone's having a blast, and it shows. And so as, you know, the creative mind behind that, to watch people do your things and have fun is very rewarding. So that's really cool. And then I also love, love, love Canaan Days. The men have worked really hard on those harmonies. There's some really tight chords they hold for a really long time, and it's very impressive.
Doug?
Well, I'm probably going to be sappy because, to me, sometimes the play is not the thing. This is a weird thing. You may not remember this, but we had a music rehearsal kind of three quarters into the run where we just sang through the show and had everybody come out on stage. And I remember a bunch of strangers at a first rehearsal, everybody's being polite and, you know, knowing each other, and the kids are all scared of each other. And you go, okay, we're a bunch of strangers and we're starting on this journey together. And then everybody was sitting there and they all looked like friends, like they've known each other for a long period of time. So the kids, the adults, back rubs, arms around each other, you know, somebody helping with some inside jokes, teasing each other. And I went, you know, I just like this place, you know, and I'm just sitting, and I was just watching everybody. I was watching you conduct your rehearsal. And it, to me, it wasn't about the beautiful music. It wasn't about, you know, the sets or what this was going to be. It was about all these strangers came together, and they were doing something together, and they loved each other.
Right.
And that's
strangers no longer.
And that's what I told them. I said, just the audience needs to see that. You go out there and you share that love with that audience, and they are going to jump up and scream.
Yeah. And particularly in this show, I mean, I think that's probably important in nearly every show.
Right.
But there's something about Joseph and just what this is all about where you really want that sense of camaraderie.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's the same thing. You know, Mary Lee was new, and she's teasing them. They're teasing her. You know, she came as a stranger, and now she's family. And all the little kids who were just hiding by their mom are now running around and doing stuff. And, you know, so yes, we're doing a great show. It's going to be a wonderful show, but it's the people that have taken this journey from the community, the people that this is what the Theater Guild does, and this is why I'm so proud to be part of it. Mm.
We should probably make mention of the fact that Noah was about to graduate from high school, so this might be the last thing we'd see him do on this stage, at least for a while.
Well, we used to say, oh, that kid, he has got this great voice, but he's taller than all the adults. You know, I very clearly remember Noah auditioning for me for like Willy Wonka or some of these other shows, and I said, you know, Charlie can't be bigger than all the male adults, you know. And so finally Noah has come of an age where his body and his beautiful voice works together. And so this is like a great role, and you know, we take great pride in him, even though I had nothing to do with his development. But, you know, watching him grow from, you know, a 10-year-old kid when I first watched him, and then playing some, you know, in Spamalot, he was in the ensemble, and then Les Mis, he was in the ensemble.
And then Fiddler.
And then Fiddler, we were able to give him a little bigger role, again, because of his age. You know, in high school, you can play any age, but, you know, when we get into our world, we cast age-appropriate. And finally, there was an age-appropriate role for Noah, and it's like, good, he gets to go out with a bang. He's going off to New York, and we can say he did it at the Theater Guild and before he went off. So,
no, I want you to say a quick word about what it's like to be in a production here versus, for instance, some of the great things you've done, for instance, at school, for instance, at Horlick, or before that at Park, and first stage up in Milwaukee. I suspect it's something a little different when you're doing something here at the Theater Guild. Not that this is better or this is worse, but I'm sure it feels different in some ways.
It definitely feels like this theater is more of a home than some of the other theaters that I've been at. Like first stage in Milwaukee, like, amazing experience, but, like, it didn't have that kind of connection that RTG has.
Well, and that's a professional sort of situation.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a job you're hired for, mm-hmm. and so on.
And, yeah, just the amount of work and time and effort that everybody's have put into this place, it's you can't help but love it, and that's how I feel about that.
Cool. Kara, I know that one thing that's kind of fun for you is not only that you have such a long relationship here with the Guild in lots of different capacities, but you are one of a number of cases in which you are in this cast with family, in a sense, more literally. Just say a word about that, if you don't mind.
No. My husband, Brian, is playing Reuben, one of the brothers. And we actually met at the Guild about a year before Joseph came through the first time.
I didn't know that.
Yes, yes. Huh. So we've known each other for about as long as Joseph has been in holding. and we've only been on stage together at the Racine Theater Guild as actors, I think, two other times. Mm. Phantom, and then when I was dropped into a production just as a fill for somebody who couldn't be there one weekend. Mm. So we've been on stage together twice.
Wow.
In the 20-some years that we've both been here. So it's kind of cool to finally be on stage together. We've worked together, of course. He does a lot of programming and backstage and stage managing and that kind of thing. So we've worked together a lot, but it's really nice to be on stage. And there's been a few times where I turn around and he's there. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's you.
Yeah, my husband.
So, yeah, it's really fun. And it's fun to see the other cast members who have family members either working backstage, because you see those connections as they pass in the hallways. It's not missed. You know, there's always those looks and high fives, and you always see the family members sitting at the end of the tunnels watching their kids in their special moments with pride. So it's really cool to share that.
Yeah, that's really nicely put. There's probably been more than those that I know. I know, like, for instance, Jamie Johnson, who was our Mary Poppins and been a part of all kinds of things, is part of our wonderful group of wives, and her son Ben,
yep,
is part of the children's chorus.
And we have Aaron and Savannah. We have
Ryan
and Logan. Mm-hmm. We have two brothers. We have John and James. Mm-hmm. Cara and Brian. We have some people working crew that are helping out. Sheila, has a couple people in the show.
Frank and Laurie,
the Munezes. I mean, it, you know, and to be honest, I don't cast according to who you're married to or who your kids are. You know, I just, sometimes it's grateful that it works out that way.
that someone's dad can swing a hammer or whatever.
Or that both people can sing and dance and they're right for the roles. Because, you know, I try really hard to cast on ability. And so I don't want people to think that they needed my dad, so they put me in the play, because that's not the case. There's been times where I cast one and not the other, and sometimes that's difficult, and then they have to decide to participate. But it's really cool that these can, again, that's one of the things that we do here. You know, they get this shared memory forever that they're performing. I still remember the organs, you know, performing with grandchildren or great-grandchildren on our stage. And they both deserved the role. It wasn't a gimme. And and they were able to perform together. Bob Benson, who was in our show, played Cratchit with his son, Connor, as Tiny Tim. And they'll have that memory forever. So it's just nice that it works out that way.
Right. Before we close, we should mention the fact that this show is nearly sold out to the point where the run was extended. Just say a word about that.
Yeah, we added three performances the 2nd and 3rd of June, and there's still some seats available for that. We have first weekend, I think, is just individual seats. First two weekends, I think. For Memorial Day weekend, we do have a number of seats together, but again, they're going fast, and so that's why I was grateful that the cast was able to extend. But, you know, some people graduate from high school, and that just stops me from adding performances. So you know, people getting married, people going out of town, you know, what's the matter with these people? But,
well, we hope that people, if they haven't already, are going to make plans to see what is just an exceptionally spectacular production here at the Racine Theater Guild, in my entirely biased opinion. Andrew Lloyd Webber's Joseph the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat opens this Friday and will run through the first weekend in June. And Doug, if people want more information or want to arrange for tickets, what do they do?
They should call the box office at 262-633-4218, or you can order tickets online at racinetheater.org.
Doug Instanis is the artistic director of the Racine Theater Guild. Mary Lee Storino, the choreographer for this production. And two of the headliners in our cast, Noah Chartrand, our Joseph, and Cara Ernst Schock, our narrator. My thanks to all of you for being part of the morning show. Best wishes.
Thank you.
For part two of today's morning show here on WGTD at 8:42, you're going to hear a portion of my conversation with Deb Neumeier. She worked for a number of years in the entertainment industry, most notably for 13 years for Amblin Productions, that's Steven Spielberg's production company, working on films like Jurassic Park and television series like ER. And then she pulled away, ended up becoming a full-time mom, and then found herself thrust back into the world of work when her husband died suddenly of a heart attack. As she re-entered the work world, she found herself really struggling to make sense of it all and trying to regain her confidence. And she ultimately wrote a book about the experience, which is designed to help others who might find themselves in somewhat the same situation. The book is called Moms for Hire, 8 Steps to Kickstart Your Next Career, published by Sky's Horse Publishing. She describes in this part of the interview a time in her life when she was a stay-at-home mom, but beginning to feel increasingly dissatisfied with that limited role.
Well, I knew that I wanted to be out there in the vibrant world. I had still friends that were working and were rising up the ladder and were becoming more successful and doing interesting things, and I sort of felt like I was swamped under a lot of tasks and chores that I couldn't figure out how to give away. And it's not only folding the laundry, but it's organizing the camp forms, and there's figuring out how to get your kids to say please and thank you, and coaxing play dates out of other moms. And, you know, there just were so many things that kept me busy and kept me cluttered. When I took my middle son on a college trip, which is really a great event, it's a transformational event, taking just one child in a car, visiting colleges. It was a rental car. It was one of those rental cars that, and he wasn't that thrilled to be going with me on this college trip. We were going to like 8 or 10 colleges in New England within 2 or 3 days. So there was a lot of driving. And I was finding myself getting more and more irritable, and I couldn't quite figure it out because, you know, I was really looking forward to the trip. It was private time with my son. It's the hopes and dreams of where they're going to go to college and what they're going to be and what their next 4 years are going to be like. And, you know, I'm an enthusiast. And all of a sudden, I had realized that he was in a bad mood, too. And he kept on turning on the heated seats in the car. And my mood would change based on how hot the seats got. And I didn't even know because it was an imperceptible thing. All I knew is that I was cranky and I was mad and he was mad and we were... And sometimes you just don't know what it is that is really not making you your best self, what is really spinning the wheels and getting you out of the funk. What I always suggest, and I suggest to the millennials I know who are looking for jobs and can't figure it out, is go to the gym for an hour every day. Something, you have to do something to sweat yourself into action. And I was feeling inactive is really how I would describe that funk. And I didn't know how to make myself active. And some people make themselves active by becoming a volunteer, by trying to do intern work, from just socializing. Some people feel active going to Starbucks every day and sitting and meeting people. Whatever it is that's going to make you feel to jumpstart you.
Mm. Do you spend a lot of time thinking about how all of this might have played out and where you would be now if your husband had not suffered this tragic heart attack which ended his life and forced you into the path you ultimately took? Do you ever stop to think about how all of this might have otherwise played out?
Endlessly. We all do. You know, had he had his heart checked? Mostly I think about him and all the things that he's missing. And why, with all the modern medicine and all the health care and health, and he actually died on a life cycle. He was working out. And there's a lot of life cycle deaths out there, you know? But I often think about who I would be and how. I know I would have gone back to work. I know I would have figured it out because women do figure it out eventually. They figure it out. They go back to a job that isn't as high paying, or they go back to a job that isn't the vice president but is an associate, or they go back as an assistant or a receptionist or an office manager. But women do go back, and they figure their way up the ladder again, or the way across the jungle gym again, however you want to describe it. But it would have been a different path, definitely. It would have been a different path for my kids. I think about it often in terms of the path that all my children have taken, because 3 days after their dad died, my husband, my youngest daughter got into early admission to the college of her choice. And he never got to know that, but he also, her path was set and her path was successful. But it would have been a different version of that path had she had a strong father who was always getting her to do this or getting her to do that or encouraging her or helping her or guiding her or discouraging her from one way or another. And the same thing with me. He was a powerful force. So not having that powerful force in our lives made us figure out our own power.
Sure. One thing that makes your situation perhaps a bit different from other women who might find themselves in what is otherwise a comparable situation where life is compelling them to enter the world of work outside of the home, and they feel tremendously intimidated. is the fact that you had this rich and interesting work history behind you. I mean, you knew of your own talents and abilities, and you knew that there was a place for you out there because you had been there and had been successful out there. And of course, that's not the reality for all women who might find themselves in this situation where they might really be entering this world in a sense for the very, very first time. I'm impressed that you are as able as you are to put yourself in their shoes. And part of the reason is that you still felt intimidated by this moment of transition, despite all of the experience you had, in a sense, behind you.
Got to be honest. When you're in it, yes, I have a very lovely resume. When you're in it, there's always someone with a better resume. There's always someone that's doing the job better than you. There's always somebody less intimidated by the powerful world. There's always someone who didn't mess up when you messed up. I had a lot of moments in which, as I said, I was fired once or twice. I quit a few more times. I had a lot of success, but I also had a lot of rejection. And I was always on my toes and never felt like I was as good. There was always somebody better than me. So that's the case with everybody. And part of one of the chapters in my book is, how do you build your own confidence? How do you find what skills you actually are an expert in? Mm-hmm. Because everybody's an expert in something.
Absolutely.
We all have transferable skills. We just have to look inside. And sometimes you have to ask your friends what your transferable skills are. I have a few worksheets in here. One that you can do yourself as to where Deborah Neumar was an expert. And then interestingly enough, I say, give it to your core four friends and ask them, what do you think I'm good at? And how does that, my own reality, you know, and it's anything from proofreading to interviewing to assisting to coaching to curating to discovering to editing to overseeing to typing to tutoring to acting to manipulating. What are the things in life that you're really good at? And it can be anything from sewing to loading a dishwasher to, you know, you might have a specific way of organizing your closet. Everybody has something.
I think this is the point where you ask people to fill out what you call their expert list.
Yeah.
And you are talking about transferable skills, skills that perhaps at that moment in time nobody is paying you to do. And maybe some of these skills no one even notices that you have or appreciate, but it's important that you know that you have these skills, and your list is a lengthy one of potential things to check off, and that can get somebody thinking about the sorts of things that they might do. Running parallel to that is another list that you want people to fill out, which is their passion list.
Mm-hmm.
Explain the difference between the expert list and the passion list.
All right. That's fantastic. I mean, your passion list is what you want to do. What's your fantasy? What are the things that you talk about at parties? What are the magazines you pick up when you pick up a magazine? What are the radio stations you listen to? What are your favorite TV shows, your books? What is it that what's your favorite website, your podcast? How do you fill your day with amusements and pleasure and enlightenment? What are those things? You've got to write them down and be specific, because from that list will grow what jobs you should be looking for. Hopefully, the real hope is that your passion, maybe it's for exercising, maybe it's for looking at the stars, maybe it's for, watching Shark Tank and trying to figure out an invention. Whatever it is that gives you, that fills up your day, write them down. Make the list and figure out what it is that turns you on. And then hopefully you put those two lists side by side. What you really love, what takes up your interest meter, and what you're good at. If you put them side to side, hopefully there's something that meshes. If not, and you're really interested in, you know, tax law, and you find yourself constantly trying to, you know, teach your kids about trees and gardening, maybe you need to go back to school or intern at the Tree of Life or get a job, you know, at a toy store for kids if you are trying to figure out what the next toy is. Whatever it is that is charming you, you have to make a list of. And it's now called Pinterest. In our day, it was called vision mapping, which is another really fun exercise. People now have vision mapping parties, which is everybody brings over their favorite four or five magazines or catalogs or anything that sort of was in their mailbox. And you come together with a few women, and you just rip out the things that are most amusing you. It's really a fascinating. Then you put it on a poster board. And it is fascinating what one discovers about themselves that they didn't even know was their impulse joy.
Hmm.
Find that.
Part of this first chapter, it's about the first step, which is kind of the phase of activating yourself to really get started on all this. One of the things you ask people to do is to uncloak your fears. And I think this is really something that could be so valuable because the suggestion is that that you take a good look, a good long look at exactly what it is that you are fearful of. What are you afraid of is going to happen if you do this? And I suppose just in the act of, in a sense, uncloaking or untying those fears, they begin to lose their power to hold you in place.
Well, that's the first step in any therapeutic move, is honestly face your fears. And, you know, normally you can move through them. Normally, once you state them, categorize them, and either accept them or say, I have to take responsibility for that one. I got to stop being mad at that person. Or say, that still is an ugly sore and I want to avoid it for now and compartmentalize it somewhere else. Or my leg is always going to hurt because I broke it once. And I'm going to have to live with a leg that still will hurt. And whatever is the obstacle, the bump that's ahead of you that's stopping you from becoming active, you got to name it, face it, and then either move forward with it or deal with it.
You also say in this with this first step that once you have really evaluated yourself and visualized what it is you want to do, and that once you're really in a sense ready, it's really important, in your words, to come out as a mom for hire, to let the world know, and not just the wider world but one's inner circle of friends and acquaintances and former colleagues and so on. And I think this is something that, because people might feel a little fearful, they might be inclined not to do this. And it's really important that they do. And especially, in a sense, the more fearful or intimidated you are, the more important it is to announce this. Explain why.
Well, a couple of reasons. A, it's the first step in AA, which is a famous step, which is a great book of steps to transformation. But it also often leads to a job, interestingly enough. One of the most jobs are actually offered through referrals. Most people find a job by letting the world know that they're looking.
Deb Neumeier.